Welcome, action fans, and thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action All the Time, as we continue our journey through the 90s filmography of Kurt Russell. I'm one of your hosts, Scott Murphy, and on today's podcast, we're talking about Stargate. And who do I mean by we? Well, of course, it's my regular partner in crime. He's one third of the Bloodhound Picks podcast. He's a screenwriter, and he's a man who's been known to have learned a language or two overnight. It's Mr. Craig Drahine.
Glad to be back.
Yeah. Excellent. Now,
Couldn't think of anything in Egyptian.
You didn't see the subtitles that had to come up there. I suppose it doesn't really work in an audio form. We're still getting used to this whole podcasting thing. You know, we've only been doing it for 3 years or so. Now, as always, before we begin, I need to do two things. First of all, I need to give you your official spoiler warning. So yes, in this podcast, we do talk about the movie from beginning to end, the whole plot. So if you've not seen Stargate and you don't want it spoiled for yourself, then go watch Stargate and come back, listen to this episode. The second thing I have to do is give you a little bit of background detail as always. So Stargate was released on October 28th, 1994. It was directed by Roland Emmerich, whose other notable credits include the likes of Universal Soldier, Independence Day, Godzilla, and many others. And it was co-written by Emmerich himself and Dean Devlin, who he collaborated on Independence Day, Godzilla, and The Patriot. Review-wise, it is currently sitting at a 7.1 out of 10 on IMDb, which I feel I should mention is the third highest IMDb score of any movie we have covered so far, only beaten out by Ronin on 7.3 and Tombstone, which I think was like 7.7 or something. Like, it was real high. The Tombstone highest score. Anyway, 53% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 47 reviews, 42 out of 100 on Metacritic based on 17 reviews, and a 3.1 on Letterboxd. At the box office, it made $196.5 million off of a $55 million budget. Interestingly, it was more popular outside of America, as it was made 71.5 domestic and $125 million international. Also, it was the 13th biggest film of 1994, sandwiched in between Clear and Present Danger at number 12 and The Santa Claus at number 14. And despite the kind of lukewarm critical reception, it did do quite well at the Sci-Fi Awards, it winning Best Sci-Fi Picture at the Saturns and being nominated for Best Dramatic Presentation at the Hugos. And of all the films we have covered thus far on the podcast, it is the film with the greatest legacy, as it was the catalyst for three TV shows, SG-1, Atlantis, and Universe, two direct-to-DVD sequels for SG-1, Arc of Truth and Continuum, a few novelizations back when that was a thing, some comic books, an animated series. So, yeah, there's a lot to the Stargate franchise. And you are familiar with the Stargate franchise, Craig, are you not? But not this movie.
Yes, I actually have seen most of all the Stargate series. I haven't seen the animated one. But yeah, I've seen everything else. But this is my first time actually watching the movie. Before that, I saw basically, we'll get to it, there's like a less than 1 minute clip of the soldiers being knocked out by Anubis, and that is the only part I saw up until this point.
So for me, kind of as we discussed over here, it's a bit different. I saw this movie a few times throughout my childhood. I saw it before SG-1 premiered in the UK. So like I was like, ah, that's, I remember that Stargate thing. Let's see what the TV show is like. And then I watched, I never watched Atlantis. I never watched Universe, but I did watch all 10 seasons of SG-1 and I watched the first direct to DVD sequel Arc of Truth, but I've never seen Continuum. People can write in and tell me if that's any good and if I should check it out. But I've not seen that one. We were kind of discussing off air a little bit as well of like my feelings for this movie. I do have some nostalgia for this movie. I remember watching this kid, and but my feelings for this movie kind of extend to my feelings towards SG-1, which is like, I like this movie. I liked SG-1, but I don't love either of them particularly. As I was, you know, saying off air, this, it kind of sat in the middle for me of like, there were shows that I kind of watched kind of ironically and saw as guilty pleasures, in terms of like the kind of sci-fi and fantasy shows that I watched as a kid, which were quite a lot of them. So there was things like Charmed and Smallville and Lex that was like, you know, I saw as kind of guilty pleasure shows. And then there were shows that I just flat out loved and adored, you know, like the Star Trek shows, the original Star Trek, The Next Generation, even Star Trek, DS9 actually as well. And then things that, you know, Doctor Who as well and Buffy, and like, I loved those shows. And yeah, SG-1 just kind of sat in the middle of just like, this is something I watch weekly, but like, and you know, I don't adore it, but like, I do like it and I like it enough that I do tune in week. And I feel like you were kind of saying a similar thing.
Yeah, that's pretty much the same. And especially watching this movie for the first time in the series, and again, what I was saying off air was this kind of notion that I think there's a lot of great ideas, but ultimately it just runs right kind of in the middle and ends up being a little more bland or generic than I think it could have been. But yeah, that's how I felt with all of the series that I watched of Stargate beforehand. And then, yeah, especially watching this movie too now.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think like part of the problem, like we'll get into it more as we discuss the plot, but I mean, part of the thing with the movie is, and I don't want to knock it too much for being derivative, because the things that is derivative of are derivative themselves. So like, I suppose you can't criticize it too heavily for that, because like, basically this movie is part, you know, like one part Star Wars, one part Indiana Jones, one part Lawrence of Arabia, one part its own thing.
Yeah.
And like I say, Indiana Jones and Star Wars themselves are derivative of other things. So like, you know, but maybe they seem less, you know, kind of, they've refashioned themselves in a more imaginative way, maybe, that kind of blinds you to their derivativeness.
No, I could see that. And I think one of the issues I had with the movie is it's either trying so hard to, like, because I know it was originally planned to be a trilogy or something. Correct. but there's moments where they leave stuff open and not a earned way, I think, for future, just, you know, reveals. But then there's also relationships that are kind of built that then are never really expanded upon more. But then they reach a point in the relationship where you think, well, that wasn't earned at all. Like between O'Neill and Jackson, or between O'Neill and can't think of his name, the kid who's kind of becomes like a surrogate son.
Scarra. The kid is called Scarra.
Yeah.
And it's played by Alexis Cruz, who is one of two actors in this movie who went on to star in a couple of episodes of SG-1.
Yes. And so there's those relationships. There's also kind of some interactions between the soldiers and Jackson. There's just a whole bunch of stuff where they reach this point where it seems like then they found this bonding and this understanding or whatever it may be. Like, and I even watched the extended version and it's like, well, but you really haven't interacted with each other at all. You're just kind of still meeting each other because like you came through the portal together and then you got separated basically.
Yeah, which we'll kind of get more into as we get into the plot. I think, yes. I mean, that is a big part of it. I mean, in terms of like the superiority of Star Wars and Indiana Jones, they are also just better told stories with more rounded characters. So it's, yeah. But shall we dive into it?
Let's do it.
So, in terms of like things that have brought me nostalgia in this show, there's definitely movies that have brought me more nostalgia rewatching them for this show, particularly the likes of Demolition Man and Under Siege and Ronin. There's definitely a few other films, but one of the things that gave me the most nostalgia from rewatching one of these films was the opening of this film. And it's not to do with so much the movie as a whole, but just the opening theme, just that, like, I think they kind of repurpose it a little bit for the show. It's not the same as David Arnold's score here, which is, this is only David Arnold's second feature film score. He would go on to score the likes of Casino Royale and the Sherlock TV show, stuff like that. But like, yeah, this gave me a kind of rush of nostalgia, just that theme. I was like, oh yeah, cool. I almost think that David Arnold's score suggests that the movie is more epic than it is.
Yeah, it does.
What did you think of the? I really like David Arnold's score for this. Like, what did you think of the music and that theme?
No, I agree actually, and that is kind of one of the parts that it weirdly the music. Yeah, it's very epic, and it fits kind of with that what you were talking about, Lawrence of Arabia aspect or all this stuff. And then there's certain moments then within the movie which we'll get into that either are more comical or more that then just don't fit with the I guess the epicness of the score, if that's an appropriate way to put it.
Yeah, I think that is an appropriate way to put it. So basically, yes, we get the score, we get the epic score as we slowly pan over the tomb of Ra. I think that, you know, as we're kind of slowly panning over as the titles roll, and then the movie itself opens in 1928, although in the director's cut, I don't know if like an extended cut for you, it would have opened in 8000 BC. Is that correct?
Yes. It shows you in 8000 BC a scene that is later when Ra is talking, or when they're finding out what Ra actually is. It's just redoing that scene that I think pops up later. And then, yeah, it goes to 1928. It does the jump, and then there's one little part, the 1928 section, where it shows you the fossilized version of the beings that we know, but which I don't think is, I don't know if it's in the theatrical. I read it wasn't, but.
No, but it's that pops not. Up again like, later they basically just, so like in the theatrical version, it kind of is like, why is this scene here? Because like basically they just arrive at the archaeological dig, and then they have a little bit of a conversation, and then the Stargate is kind of erected, and they're like, kind of like, what is that? Nobody knows. And then it just kind of cuts to the Daniels lecture at the university or wherever the lecture hall that he's at. And like the other thing that was, I thought it was kind of weird about the scene as well. And maybe this is just like a kind of us in the '90s. Of course, we don't care about non-white people, but like they subtitled the Swedish, but not the Arabic. And I was just like, but why? Like,
Yeah. No, there's a whole part too that we'll get into when they first arrive where there's no subtitles really. And then later on, I don't know if it was a director's choice because now, Jackson, when he officially understands what they're saying, then we get the subtitles but yeah, it's kind of weird with how they handle the subtitles in that movie.
Yeah, it is kind of weird. We'll discuss that more when we get there, I suppose. But I think like this is kind of like the main bits that are kind of changed in the extended cut. There is also like a little battle that I didn't get that happens later on, but we'll talk about that later on, I suppose. But anyway, we're kind of on the same path now. So we cut to Dr. Jackson's or Daniel's lecture, Dr. Jackson, played by James Spader, and he's giving a lecture about how the pyramids were apparently not built by the fourth dynasty of pharaohs, and he's being laughed at by other academics. And one of them rather amusingly, given that one of the spin-off shows ended up being Stargate Atlantis, was he actually mentions Atlantis and like, what were they built by Atlanteans? And then walks away.
And it's, I don't know, the whole thing is him just basically, everybody leaves, but Spader, his character is kind of interesting where they give him quirks, but then they're not there sometimes. He's kind of the comic relief, but then, yeah, he kind of jumps weirdly back and forth, but he assumes that, oh, why'd everybody leave? Because of lunch. But everybody in the audience made it very clear why they were leaving to his face. It's not like.
Yeah, they didn't try and hide it. Yeah. It's kind of, he's kind of weak, and I'm not. I suppose you're right. I suppose he does kind of, he is sometimes the comic relief, and he is sometimes the quirky eccentric, and then sometimes he's kind of not. He's kind of like being the leader with, when they go to the other planet and stuff like that. And yeah, he's a bit like, obviously Roland Emmerich also directed like Independence Day. And he's like, he's like both Jeff Goldblum's character and Will Smith's character sometimes.
Yeah. And that's how he becomes, especially that he's just a linguist and you're kind of, I don't know. That's not a high enough position, I feel like, for him to really be in control of how he's seen at least, but I don't know. That's a whole nother conversation.
I suppose we'll get to that too. Like, maybe we should just talk about the things we were talking about instead of talking about the things that we're going to talk about. It might get a little bit too confusing for all the listeners. So we'll cut back to the plot. So basically, after the lecture, he is offered a job by Catherine Langford, and he doesn't want to take the job, but she basically knows everything about him and says, like, I know that you've lost your job, you're behind on your rent, you basically can't afford not to take this secondment with the US Air Force secret something or other. And then he's like, well, I suppose that's true, so I'll just go to your secret military base.
Yeah, and when he's there, he jumps right in a way that, I guess that, again, that's where his character element comes in of, like, he has this, he's just, I guess, intelligent, I don't know, but he comes off cocky to everybody else, even though he's not trying to be, of where he comes in, looks at the board, and basically, like, rewrites the guy's translation. Saying, oh, this is wrong. He's crossing everything out and going through it.
I really enjoy that scene where he, like, they've been working on this translation for, like, ages. And, like
it says 2 years, I know, in one part.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure if they've been working on that specific translation for 2 years.
Oh.
Like, I feel like it's the dials, like the symbol, you know, like the symbols for the,
oh, yeah,
the dial in. They've been, like, kind of working on for 2 years, like the kind of, the Stargate part of it. But, like, yeah, so there's that translation on the board and he's like, oh, it's all wrong. And, you know, this word actually says Stargate, which is, yeah. So, like, I actually kind of wanted more of this because I love the antagonism between, the kind of unintentional antagonism between his character, Spader's character, Dr. Daniel Jackson, and Richard Kine's character, who is just, like, upset by everything he does. It's like, Richard Kind's like just lugubrious face of just kind of, I'm just not impressed. I could have done with more of that. I think more Richard Kind in this movie would have gone down well with me, I feel.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that's kind of what lacks a little bit, in my opinion, is that like, it becomes a kind of more full-fledged adventure action movie, even with Spader's character, where I feel like the parts, like the science parts, are a lot of fun, and I almost wish there was more of that in it, of him trying, you know, later on trying to decipher things or whatever, because it feels like it's just, like he solves everything really quickly. I wish there was more of that in there, even if Richard Kind's character did come with them or something.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean, because a lot of, I think, in terms of, like, the dialogue, and in terms of, like, the kind of back and forth that way, I think some of the most fun stuff comes out of those scenes, and the fact that like Richard Kind just feels usurped by this like new guy who's come in and just solved everything, and it's like he's just crestfallen that he's been working on it for years, and it's just like this guy comes and solves everything in a fortnight, like don't I just feel like a piece of shit.
Yeah. But we forgot to mention right before that point.
We get the introduction of
Russell, who is kind of in a depressive state, and his wife is too, or she's kind of detached from him, and he has long hair.
That's how we know he's in a depressive state.
It's revealed that he's.
Because he's a military guy and he's got long shoulder length hair, so that's like cinematic shorthand for that.
Yeah, and it's revealed that his son accidentally killed himself with one of O'Neill's guns, basically what the soldiers say to each other.
Yeah, and this is revealed, I mean, like, yes, the soldiers have this conversation in this car, and his son's death, I feel, is revealed in the clunkiest manner. Of, you know, it's just this throwaway conversation that they have in the car, like, hey, why is he so depressed? Well, his son died. He shot himself with a gun, and it was in the house. Oh, okay. Let's drive away from this scene now. Ah, well, thanks. You've given the audience the information that they required. Now you can write off.
And that's the... Yeah. And that's kind of what I was talking about in the beginning of even watching this movie, is then they give this relationship that's supposed to be the surrogate son with him, but then it never feels like you could just have, why does he doesn't even need a son by the time you're watching this, you're like, oh, there was no reason at all for this, except to maybe throw in some forced kind of character development or some, you know.
Yeah.
Or some sympathy.
Pretty much. Like, it feels very shoehorned in, and it's like, most of the times he doesn't seem all that depressed, and then every so often he does. And it's not, I mean, Kurt Russell plays the kind of transitions well, but the transitions are still weird.
Yeah.
I suppose this might be a good time to mention as well that, like, so... I read a couple of fun things about Kurt Russell and James Spader in terms of them coming aboard in this movie. Kurt Russell got the script, thought the script was rubbish, didn't want to do it, and then was basically convinced to do it by his agent, because they were like, ah, they're now offering you this amount of money. And he was like, okay, cool. But it turns out in an interview I read with Dean Devlin that he was sent the wrong script. He was sent an early first draft of the script, which Dean Devlin himself said was awful, but wasn't sent the final shooting script. And when Kurt Russell saw the final shooting script, he was like, ah, this isn't so bad after all. However, James Spader thought the script was just awful generally. He was sent the right script, but James Spader was quoted as saying this: the script was just awful, and that sort of intrigued me. I don't know where James Spader is going with this. I don't know why you would think a script is rubbish and being like, hey, I want to know more, but he did. And then he goes on to say, that made me want to meet the director. And then he got me excited about it. I realized that making this picture was going to be such an adventure. He apparently was keen on shooting in the desert. And that out of that would come an adventure on screen. So James Spader had a very interesting attitude to this movie.
Yeah, but that's how I feel with most of Emmerich's movies, is that, I don't know, why watching them, you're kind of like, but, you know, it was fun for the cat, for everyone involved to do, to make it. Because it seems like, you know, you get to mess around with the special effects or whatever. I think it could be fun, but then, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it turned out it wasn't that fun. Like, I also watched, like, the behind-the-scenes documentary that you can see on YouTube. And, like, it was fun in terms of, like, apparently the camaraderie on set was good. People got on well. That was nice. But they shot in Yuma, Arizona. And to avoid the June buggy season, they shot right in the height of summer in July. So they were shooting in, like, 126 degree Fahrenheit kind of heats, and people were just collapsing on set, basically.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I guess. Because oddly enough, in the ultimate edition that I have, even though it's the ultimate edition, it only has one kind of special feature, and that is talking about, is Stargate real? And it's okay. Just like one of those. Like, here's the science behind it, and it does not work at all to this podcast.
No. Do you know what's great, though? Like, I think, when I was reading up on it, the behind-the-scenes documentary, and this is the most 90s shit ever, comes from a Stargate CD-ROM.
Oh, there you go.
And in terms of technology as well, apparently Stargate was the first major motion picture to have an official website.
Okay, that's cool.
But we're only about 10 minutes into the movie, so we should probably keep on trucking.
Yeah. So O'Neill comes in and basically takes control of everything, of saying that he's going to be the one to know and any sort of information, and that it's only military should be in the know. And he obviously does not think highly of Jackson. And so they're supposed to be at odds, kind of, but Jackson, because he's a little naive to certain things, he doesn't really even notice that he's at odds, I guess, with O'Neill. He's just kind of going along with the flow and excited. Yeah. Yeah, so we get basically a scene of Jackson going to get coffee, and he realizes that the symbols that they haven't been able to translate are actually those of star constellations. So he's finally able to crack the piece of the seventh seal. Well, he's able to crack six of them. He knows the seventh seal, but it's not the same as what's on the Stargate. And that's when he doesn't know what that means, but it's revealed to him. As the whiteboard raises up to show the Stargate.
Dun, dun, dun. This is one of the funny things about the scene as well. Just rewatching it this time, I was like, so when he translates the thing, he's like, that word's not wrong. That word's not right. It should be Stargate. And I was like, oh, okay. So he's uncovered that word, but then everybody in this scene is calling it the Stargate, and he doesn't know what that is. So I'm like, were they calling it the Stargate before he arrived and did the translation? But then, like, what context would they have for calling it the Stargate? Like, maybe I just got myself caught up in knots.
Yeah, no, I agree, because there are points where it feels like with the first initial blackboard element or that scene. Like, where did they just write it that way to try and test him a little bit to see if he would be able to see how good he was? And they actually knew what it meant regardless, because Catherine kind of seems like she already knows the translation stuff. And when they reveal, they already know that the six of the seven symbols prior to that. And so, yeah. it kind of plays weird in that sense of.
Yeah, because then you're like, oh,
did they know or not?
More than they were letting on originally? Or, like, but then, like a lot of things in this movie, it's not entirely fully explained.
Yeah, but they test it and they finally get the Stargate open and they send in a probe that kind of shows them where in the known universe that it goes, basically.
Yes, which is, it's in a galaxy far, far away. But in the show, it's in our galaxy, so that's one of the things that they change from this movie to SG-1. And also, one of the interesting things that I learned from the research in like behind the scenes documentary is the Stargate effect is done practically, because they had a large tank of water and they shot an air cannon at it from about an inch above it, and then they turned the image on its side and digitally enhanced it a bit, and that's how the Stargate whooshy watery effect is done. It wasn't all CGI.
I mean, it still looks good for, you know, what it and it's kind of one of those nostalgia effects, I think, that has been replicated so much by now in terms of, you know, Stargate.
Yeah, for sure. And I think like a lot of films, particularly if you watch films from the 90s where like the effects are like purely CGI, often they don't hold up well, but effects that are a mixture of practical and like kind of digital enhancements often stand up better to rewatching now than like kind of pure computer effect.
I agree. And so, you know, moving on is that they want to get, basically, since the probe was only able to capture a little bit, they want to send in a team. But unfortunately, the only way to get back through is to know what constellations to use. And the symbols on the other side are completely different than that on the Earth side. And Jackson, he just jumps right in of saying that he'll do it, even though O'Neill says he's full of shit. Yeah, but he still allows him to. And the general says, "Well, you're on board," as the team is going to go in to the Stargate.
Yeah, it is pretty hilarious how in this scene. I know, again, this is one of those scenes that, like, yeah, it has to be this way for the plot to continue. But like, nobody at any point before they go on this exposition says like, How can you get us back? And then he has to explain. Yeah. He's just like, I can get us back. I'm sure I can. And then we just kind of goes, yeah, okay. Seems legit. Seems like a smart guy. Found the symbol. Cool.
Yeah. That's the, because then when they get across and they have to figure it out, he's like, well, I can't figure it out right away. I need to be able to find other symbols to, you know, figure it out. And everybody gets upset with them. Like, why don't you know it right away? Why can't you just get us back? We don't need to go anywhere.
Yeah, no, they are very pissed. Like, I think it's very funny how the Lieutenant Kowalski is just like, he is like, you, after Daniel says, I just assumed. And he's just the way he says, you assumed? And you practically see the vein popping in his forehead.
And, oh, this is part of one of the team members, and this is our, I guess, connection to the Stallone season and to us talking about Third Rock from the Sun on the Stallone season, is French Stewart is one of the soldiers.
Yes, indeed he is. He plays Lieutenant Ferretti, one of the few soldiers, like, basically, the soldiers are not really given much characterization, apart from Kowalski is given some, and French Stewart's character, Ferretti, is also given some. The rest of the team, apparently we don't really care about them. And this was also French Stewart's film debut.
Oh, wow. And this, I don't know, it's interesting because it kind of goes with the, what was our executive decision episode of having some cast members that don't necessarily seem like they fit with like the Ultimate Special Forces, best of the best.
Craig, you're giving away our secrets. Really? You're not supposed to give away our secrets that we recorded this episode after we recorded Executive Decision, even though this episode will go out before the Executive Decision episode.
Oh, yep, I got all mixed up.
So we've not seen Executive Decision yet.
No.
Even though we totally have, it's fine. It's fine. Don't worry about it. It's timey-wimey stuff. It's, you know, just like the Doctor.
Yeah.
back to the plot, Craig.
One key element that we forgot to mention is Catherine, when she was a kid, she found, it's like a locket of the Ra symbol, and she hands it to Jackson saying, "This gave me good luck my whole life. I want you to hold on to it and bring it back to me." And so that is like our, it's like our Chekhov's gun, but it's a Chekhov's locket, kind of.
Yes.
That plays an important role.
Yeah. For sure. For sure it does. So that definitely needs to be mentioned. Also, I feel like we should maybe mention as well, I have put in my notes, before they reach the planet, which is called, a Baos, but it's never actually mentioned in the film. It's just mentioned in the behind the scenes. And then you find out what the planet is called if you watch SG-1 as well. I've put in my notes, Daniel goes through the Stargate after fucking about a bit, because he kind of puts his face in the watery stuff, and he's kind of he's playing about with it, he's putting his hands in it, and then you get a kind of whooshy 2001 style effect as you go through the Stargate.
Yeah. And so when they get back, when they get to the other side, it's basically a replica of the pyramids of Giza, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And,
Great Pyramid of Giza.
Yeah. And so it's just a desert. And then there isn't, because it's more of a replica of that, there isn't necessarily, any tablets, or there isn't any sort of elements that would indicate what the symbols would be. So that's what leads to kind of all the frustration with the team, because since there is no writing anywhere, Jackson is unable to figure out what each symbol means. So he wants to go and explore more, see if there's civilization, whatever. And O'Neill is kind of in this stance of he just wanted to go through and then turn around and walk right back again, drop something off just in case, which will play a part later on that, he has this package to deliver. But it is kind of interesting that they would bring it for an idea of going through one way and back the other quickly. They brought as much equipment and as big of a team as they did.
That is true. They brought a bunch of supplies. If they were just kind of going in and out, why did they bring a whole bunch of food and tents and a lot of guns? It's kind of weird. You think that they'd be setting up for a couple of weeks, maybe, given all the stuff that they have brought. Apparently the plan was just in and back out again. So there we go. So we see O'Neill kind of setting something up. It's a bomb, spoiler alert. And while that's happening, friend Stuart is bullying Daniel and throwing his books about and kind of saying shouldn't you be trying to get us back home? And then just, throwing his books about. But again, Daniel doesn't really react to anything in this film, so he's just that's cool, whatever. I'll just retrieve my books, and then he's again, we're kind of playing on this kind of he's a real eccentric, so he doesn't really care. He just lives in his own kind of world or whatever. And while he's sitting amongst his books, he sees a kind of strange alien horse thing that is called a mastig. The mastig is apparently, that effect was achieved by, it was there's a kind of plastic frame with fur and stuff like that on top of a Clydesdale horse. So that's how that was done. Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. I mean, and it's a fact because I thought it was just going to be, you know, like a puppet or animatronic or whatever.
No, not an animatronic. A light plastic frame with some fur and stuff, just on top of a Shire horse. But the interesting thing is, like, Daniel interacts with it and gives it a little bit of a candy bar, but then he gets caught up. And it's got a harness in that, and it gets caught up in that, and he gets dragged off by it, and that effect's even more interesting because the Clydesdale horse, it, like, because of the heat and stuff, and because it was too, the frame was kind of too heavy for it to gallop, that effect where he's being dragged over the dunes, he's not being dragged over the dunes. Basically, there was a mini plastic frame with the same fur and stuff that was made for a dog, and what you're seeing there is a dog dragging a puppet over sand dunes, but it is achieved in such a way that you don't really pick that up.
It works well, and I think this is kind of one of those moments that I was talking about before, where, like, the epic music and everything, and then there's a scene like this that then feels silly, and it's like, you know, even the soldiers watching it happen, it's like a aw shuck type moment that doesn't fit, but I don't know. It's one of those tonal things that doesn't mesh with other elements of the movie.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There's some bit of later on as well, but, like, it's kind of one of those kind of big campy moments that is just, like, feels kind of weird because we get some of these, but there's not enough of them to be like, oh, this is like a big campy tongue-in-cheek thing, and you know, like, it seems relatively, you know, it's not super serious. We're not talking Snyder versus Grim Dark here, but, like, it takes itself relatively seriously. And then, but there is these kind of big campy moments. Although, in the Dean Devlin interview that I read, I think maybe they wrote it more tongue-in-cheek, and he said that the actors didn't fully get the tone of it until later on in the movie, so I don't know. But then...
Okay, yeah, that makes sense, because some of it does feel like, we're talking about that you would see from, you know, a few years later with, like, the 1999, or the Brendan Fraser, The Mummy.
Yeah, right.
Or things like that, where it was kind of like a throwback adventure, where it was silly, had its silly elements, even though it was serious at times or whatever it may be.
Yeah, for sure. But it doesn't, yeah, for the most part, it doesn't play campy. But then again, if the actors weren't really getting the tone just right, then surely that's a directorial issue in terms of, like, Emmerich being like, actually, you know, it's, can you play it that way? Because this is kind of the vision me and Dean have for the movie.
Because Kurt Russell up until this point hasn't really been a huge ego, so it seems, and he's done a lot of kind of campy action film, it seems like he'd be an easy one to talk to about those issues.
Yeah, because I mean, he's got a proven track record from, like, the likes of Big Trouble in Little China and, you know, Tango and Cash and stuff like that, of being campy, although it feels like his character's not really meant to be campy, although, or maybe he's meant to be more quippy, action hero-y, like, in the second half of the movie. Like, his character's arc is kind of odd, because he kind of comes in and out of, as we've kind of described, he kind of comes in and out of this depression, and it's a bit weird.
Yeah. No, exactly. For the first, I'd say, half of the movie, Kurt Russell's character is almost, like, it's basically all Spader, it feels like. And Kurt Russell's character is just kind of there, doing something, kind of, but not really.
Yeah, that is true. But I suppose we must skip along as we get to, like, basically this is where they meet the kind of townsfolk, like they come across the alien mine that is being mined by what looks like just like humans, which we will later discover are actually humans. And as we kind of discussed at the start of the episode, initially these people who are speaking some variation of ancient Egyptian are not subtitled. And I don't know, I guess from the director's point of view, this is to place us in the kind of viewpoint of the characters of the military team and, you know, Jackson, of like not being able to understand.
Yeah, which is funny again because Jackson gets yelled at for not knowing their language right away. Like, well, you're on an alien planet. How would you know it right away? Obviously, it's not like the same elements of if they traveled to a different country. But for most of the beginning, the soldiers just get frustrated with him the whole time of why he can't solve something right away.
Yeah, that does seem to be the main thrust of his character's journey up to this point. Of just like, you're the smart guy. Fucking, how do you not know? Smart guy.
Yeah, but I do like the response where, so they're talking to the chief and they end up, like, they're kind of communicating. They offer water. He offers them a candy. He offers them a candy bar. And then the chief makes the motion of come with me. And Jackson goes, he wants us to go with them. And Kowalski makes some kind of rude comment about, well, how do you know that? And he makes the motion. It's like, because he wants us to come with him. Or whatever he says.
Yeah, he makes the obvious kind of hand motion of like, come towards this way. that is very funny. And then, we've kind of got two groups. We probably should explain that some of the soldiers went after Daniel when he got dragged away by the mastic, and some of the soldiers stayed at base camp, including French Stewart. And so, like, it's like Kowalski and O'Neill and Jackson and Brown, I think. I don't know if there's any other soldiers. The soldiers are so kind of not there that I actually forget how many soldiers there are. There's just them. Basically, the ones we've mentioned are the ones that stick out in the mind. And so there's two groups there.
Brown is kind of supposed to be the nice one. I don't know. Like, that's how that's his only character trait, of that he's the nice one to Jackson.
Yes, he is more kind. But yeah, he's given literally nothing to do. So yeah, that's his one character trait. And I don't want to call this movie racist, but again, it does kind of feel like, yes, but we've given characterization to our more important white characters.
Yeah, well, and again, spoiler alert, it does, the way they set up Brown is then, like, he's supposed to be the nice one, you think, so then when he is, again, spoiler, killed later on, like, it's supposed to have this weight, but then it doesn't really, because they haven't given him enough depth. They've just kind of given him the lines of being like, well, maybe I think Jackson might be right, you know, and that's it.
Yeah, pretty much. So, and again, that is entirely a script issue and has nothing to do with Derek Webster's performance, which is perfectly adequate. It's fine. He's decent in the role.
Exactly. Yes.
But we kind of, so again, this is kind of where like the kind of references come in, or the kind of derivative bits of like, so we get a scene where we go back to a big party feast in the town, and then it's basically like, oh, we should just eat what the locals eat and stuff like that. You know, Daniel's very much on board for that. Kowalski, not so much. And then they present this kind of lizard thing, and, you know, with the kind of meat hanging out. And, you know, Karski's kind of like, ah, are you going to eat that? And Daniel seems kind of unperturbed, kind of, you know, it's a similar to the kind of banquet scene in, Indiana Jones and stuff like that. But it kind of plays differently because Indiana Jones is genuinely disgusted, whereas Daniel's like, ah, weird lizard meat. Ah, I'll check it out. And of course it tastes like chicken because everything tastes like chicken. Any white meat in the universe tastes like chicken, apparently.
And so he tries to start writing, and as he's doing it, the chief is basically kicking the sand and trying to prevent him from writing. But then and they see the symbol of Ra, right, on his locket thing. And so they instantly start putting him in this robe and cleaning Daniel while the other soldiers are just still there. And so you're going through this whole scene of seeing Daniel being cleaned, and then the chieftain's daughter comes in, having her wed Daniel, basically, are giving her to him because they assume that he is an emissary of Ra.
That is true. Which they already knew because they've already seen the locket.
Yeah.
Because like in the first scene where they meet them, like everybody like kind of bows down to him because like they've already seen the locket. I think like it was this kind of like, oh, he knows writing as well. That's pretty amazing. On top of the emissary thing, oh, I definitely gotta give my daughter away. The chieftain of the village, Kasuf, is played by Eric Avari, who is kind of one of those actors who's just kind of put in roles of like, he can be Indian, he can be Iraqi, he can be Egyptian, he can be Tunisian. He's just like one of those actors that they were just like, yeah, he's like Middle Eastern, right?
And he is in The Mummy. There you go.
He is in The Mummy.
He was actually born
in India, but like he's played basically every kind of Asian culture, Asian, you know, characters from pretty much every kind of Asian and North African country that's not like a Far East Asian country. So it's like, Hollywood just casts him as anything because, you know, ethnicity is kind of elastic and, you know, particularly in the 90s.
Yeah, but we get one of those scenes, kind of moving on, where Jackson is, you know, to show that he's a good person. He doesn't take advantage of the chieftain's daughter. He has her put her clothes back on, but they act like he is interested as to not offend any of them because they're basically waiting right outside of his hut or his room. And
they're kind of all standing around waiting for the consummation of the marriage. And then this is where they have a sort of conversation of where he starts writing stuff again, and like she's like, no, don't do that. And then but then she recognizes a symbol, and that kind of starts off like the catalyst for Daniel learning the language overnight. But this is also intercut with the one scene that you have seen from this movie before watching it for this podcast.
Yes. So you have the other soldiers, the French Stewart and his crew, which he's kind of like a third in command. I don't know what his title is, but he is a giant spaceship that looks like a pyramid. It is basically floating and lands right over the other pyramid where they're at during really bad sandstorm happens, which causes them to go inside. And then through it, there's kind of these unseen soldiers that start picking off. I want to say there's four on the team in there that starts picking them off kind of one by one in this building and in this kind of big room and through, you know, hiding behind pillars or whatever it is. And then French Stewart is able to get a glance and see one, but I think he's the only one out of that group that's actually, or no, there's one, so there's two of them that are actually not killed, I feel like.
Yeah, that's right.
French Stewart and there's the one other, and then the other two you assume are killed because, well, I mean, they're not shown again after that point, but that's really all that you see from that, yeah.
Yeah, and even though it's not explained like it is in Star Trek, apparently those, like, laser staffs can be set to stun and set to kill because, like, they are of various strengths at various times in the movie.
Yeah, and there's some that, yeah, and it's even different in terms of the stun. There's, like, a stun where it just zaps them, or there's a stun they'll blow them across the room, or, yeah, they didn't really figure out what the caliber of those staffs are.
Nope. And it's fine. You could just, like, I can accept that they have, like, different levels to them, but, like, at least in a, you know, in Star Trek with the phasers and stuff, you can see, like, they've got, like, a little dial that's like, oh, this set to stun.
Yeah.
Again, you know, maybe I'm asking too much in terms of logic of the movie, but the lack of consistency in the laser blasts always kind of perturbed me.
No, that makes sense, because it is just a regular staff that they're holding. For the most,
you don't really get to see the work. And this is an interesting thing as well. So, like, I was just going to say about this attack on the soldiers in terms of the structure of this film is that it happens, like, I clocked it. I decided to write the time down. This attack happens 56 minutes and 29 seconds into the film, which is, like, a long time for this to kick in as an action adventure.
It was kind of the weird part, because the movie, in terms of that screenwriting structure that they make up, where by 15 minutes you have the inciting incident, by 30 minutes you have the act break, and so on and so forth. By 30 minutes is when they go through the Stargate. So up until that point, it all kind of makes sense. But yeah, then it's just kind of a lot of getting to know the area. There are a lot of pauses for the type of movie it's trying to be.
Yeah, for the kind of big sci-fi action adventure, it doesn't really have, like, zippy pacing. Like, there is a lot of kind of detours and just kind of, and not particularly, like, characterful detours in terms of, like, we don't, like, learn loads more about the characters. The detours don't necessarily give the film more depth. It's just, like, there's just some scenes that just feel like kind of, oh, we're just hanging out. We're just kind of, it feels kind of meandering. But then, like, you know, when the action does happen, it's cool. And, you know, there is cool scenes in the movie, and there's a lot of fun stuff here. But yeah, it's kind of oddly paced for this type of film.
So after that happens, you see Kurt Russell as O'Neill, and the kid is coming up, and he shows them the lighter, and he gives them the lighter, and smoke a cigarette and coughs, and he throws on the ground, and, you know, it's supposed to add kind of a humorous element, but then he grabs the gun, and O'Neill quickly yells at about, you know, grabbing the gun and that it's not safe, but he doesn't understand that element. Because, you know, they're not speaking the same language. But it's like scenes like that that feel like they're meant to kind of start building the relationships more or the characters more, but then they don't really, even though I guess on paper it seems like it would. But maybe if the movie was 2.5 hours or longer, where they could actually kind of develop these relationships better, it'd make more sense. But it just really doesn't go anywhere. Even by the end point where they're, again, spoiler, when they're giving salutes to each other, it doesn't feel earned. It just feels like a bunch of scenes.
Yeah, I would agree with that, for sure. Yeah, a lot of those scenes just kind of sit there. Even though, I mean, they are perfectly well played. I think most people play their parts pretty well in the movie. You know, Alexis Cruz is pretty good as Scara. We've not really talked about Daniel's bride, Shauri, who's played by Mili Avital. She's pretty good, and even though she's not given a lot to do, but yeah, there's something about them that they don't add much flesh to the bone, really.
Exactly. And I think, because I was going to talk about her more, but it pops up in a lot of Westerns, it pops up in other, you know, this notion of a character being married off to maybe the people of that planet. I'm pretty sure it's happened on a Star Trek episode, or any sci-fi series you find has some part of it. But yeah, she just kind of plays that role of the quiet who instantly falls in love with him. And again, that's kind of it for her, besides the fact that she leads Daniel to the cavern, or the caves, which actually have the writing, where he's able to finally kind of decipher everything, except that the seventh symbol is still all worn off and missing. But he's able to figure out kind of the history through a big exposition dump that he ends. Yeah. And the symbols in itself. And that kind of solves all of the science elements that we liked so much earlier. It's like, oh, okay, here's all your science. And back to kind of action part, and we're bringing in Ra now.
Yeah, although I do have to say, in terms of like, some of the filler scenes are quite funny, and one of the funny filler scenes, before we get to the scene where we find out, oh, we can't find the seventh symbol, has been rubbed off where the team kind of meets back up again. Like, there is a scene where Kurt Russell, as O'Neill, is trying to find Jackson, because Jackson's gone off with Shaori to these caves so he can learn the language in a couple of hours, it seems. And he is talking to Skara, Alexis Cruz's character, and his kind of group of other boys that he hangs out with. And he, obviously, they don't speak the same language, so they're trying to communicate back and forth. And they kind of clock that he's talking about Daniel, but they know him through like his reaction to the chicken. Like, when he ate the lizard meat, he said, oh, it tastes like chicken, and then did like a chicken clucking noise. And then we just have this weird random scene where there's loads of these boys going, they're doing this chicken clucking noise. And like Kurt Russell's like, yeah, chicken man. So I thought that was kind of a fun scene.
No, that's the funny part, because he's trying to do the glasses and he's trying to do everything else, and they're just not getting it. And at one point he even mentions, I'm sure you don't know it, or dweeb means nothing in your language, or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's some of his funniest lines come in that scene. Kurt Russell gets to have a bit of fun. But then, as we mentioned, they go into the caves. They find out that there is no seventh symbol after finding the other symbols. So that's, god damn it. And we've not really talked much about the kind of the bomb that they have, they discover this is where like Brown and another soldier die, and then they discover the nuke is missing, and then everybody is transported to Ra's throne room. And again, I've written this down because it's interesting just in terms of like the way the movie's structured. Ra is the main villain of the film. And even though we've seen him in flashback not that long before, this is his proper villain introduction. And it happens an hour and 16 minutes into the film. I watched the theatrical cut of the film that is on Prime. This film is in total 2 hours and a minute long. And yes, this introduction happens an hour and 16 minutes into the movie. So we've got like basically the last 45 minutes of the film for this villain to make an impact.
Yeah, and it does feel kind of strange, because throughout, when you're figuring out what happened, you learn that Ra was an alien where his whole race, had died off, and it was trying to find a way for immortality and found humans. And when we see if you watch the extended cut, you'll see it at the very beginning. If you watch the theatrical, it plays during this exposition, but you have kind of this person who went up to the pyramid, and then what we know of Ra basically sent himself into this human body, because what we learn is that human bodies are easier to fix than other alien races, and able to make immortal through what we find later on, this I don't know. It's like a pool of water that fixes things. but yeah, it kind of, you get all of that. So what also happened was Ra was on Earth, but then Earth started an uprising and sent him back through the portal. And that's why he banned all writing and everything with the slaves that were already on his planet's side. So that they would never know the history and they wouldn't be able to rise up again against him. Or, yeah. And that is basically that whole section. And then, but during it, we get the death. Well, not really spoiler, but we get the death of Jackson because of O'Neill. Like it kind of, he gets shot through it. And then O'Neill is sent into, a prison where you find Kowalski, you find, Ferretti, and you find, there's one more soldier who is just random soldier. Doesn't really have any purpose other than what is about to happen.
Yeah, that's true. They're thrown into this kind of watery prison. And yeah, the anonymous other soldier guy. There is a couple of interesting things that I want to mention in from this scene. So first of all, Ra is played by Jay Davidson, who is most famous for his role that he had a couple of years before this, where he was in The Crying Game. And he basically didn't really like the fame that gave him, and didn't really want to act again. And when he was approached to act in this movie, he said, "Sure, I will act if you give me $1 million, thinking that was too outrageous a fee for them to actually give him that. So that was his play. But then they were like, "Sure, we'll give you $1 million. And he was like, "Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll act in the film then." Sadly, apparently he had some drug and alcohol issues at the time, which led to him having to have like big cue cards on set because he kept forgetting his lines. So yes. And he didn't do that much after this. He basically just did a couple other roles and then just returned to being like a fashion model, because obviously he preferred that to acting and, or to the particular type of fame that he got from being in the movies. Apparently could keep a lower profile, as a model. So, the kind of strange career of Jay Davidson and the strange detour for him. And also in this scene, we get a cameo from Dinjun Hunsu, who people will know from the likes of Gladiator and Amistad and stuff like that. But this was one of his earliest, one of his earliest kind of substantial supporting roles as like kind of the number two henchman. Horus, like Anubis is like the kind of number one henchman, but he's like the number two henchman. So that's the couple of things that I wanted to highlight from this particular scene. But as we roll on plot wise, we get a village, the village is attacked by Ra's forces. And you want to tell us more about that, Craig?
Yeah, so Ra sends out, it's basically two fighter jet things to go and just lay siege to the city as basically a warning, a warning for and a punishment for helping the travelers, because the whole point is that Ra does not want these people to ever think that know who I guess they are specifically, that they're not gods, and yeah, he just wants to make sure that he keeps control. So he even at point decides to use Daniel, taking off the locket, saying that, you know, they will only know of one Ra, that I'm going to have you kill your own team, or I'm going to destroy you, because they need to know my power. And so, yeah, basically goes to this whole thing. And at this time too, kind of the group of youth are starting to realize that, you know, they've been tricked their whole life and they're kind of wanting to start a rebellion a little bit. But the chieftain and yeah, anybody that's a little bit older are more upset about the fact of that we angered the gods, and they still kind of believe in that.
And just before that, like the kind of the start of the rebellion being on. Obviously, you mentioned before the kind of watery tomb thing that kind of, you know, repairs wounds and stuff like that and keeps Ra immortal. And it does the same magic for Daniel's wounds. But it's kind of weird. It's kind of like, why did he do that? Like, you know, it's like, you know, they've killed off these other soldiers. They're clearly enemies. It's just like, why did they keep Daniel around? It's like, oh, we're going to save Daniel because I really need somebody to give this villain speech to. So yeah, this guy, I want to give the villain speech to this guy.
Yeah, that's how it feels. I mean, I was wondering the same thing watching it. I didn't know, well, is it because Daniel knows their language or because he's wearing the locket thing that also has the symbol of Ra that he feels like he just needs to tell him. But then you're like, well, based on the plan that you've created, don't technically need Daniel. I mean, he doesn't even need to kill his own team for your plan to really work. But yeah, for some reason, he decides to fix him up just to be able to kill him again, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. We're looking for logic where there probably isn't any. So that is one of the many themes of the show. But yes, Bra basically orders Daniel to execute his team. So he's given one of the laser staffs, which is very kind of very trusting of Ra to be like, oh, I'm going to give you, you're definitely going to do this. We've definitely agreed to this. You're definitely not going to double cross me and shoot any of my men with that laser staff that I've just given you. That's definitely not going to happen. Daniel's got a hard look in his eye. It looks like he's going to kill O'Neill, Kowalski, and Ferretti. As an audience member, you're like, but he's not, right? You know, that's not going to happen. But, you know, but they're really playing it up. And James Spader has given it his all to try and convince us that this is totally going to happen. He is going to execute his own men. But then that's, of course, until we see that amongst the crowd who have come to witness this execution is Skara and the boys. And they kind of give the nod and show under the robes. They got the guns that O'Neill and the team brought. For some reason, even though apparently they were just going to come and then leave again. So the rebellion is on and a battle starts. And of course, as predicted, Daniel does turn that laser staff on Ra's men.
Well, and it's interesting during that whole thing, it would make more sense if they made Daniel, you know, again, with character development, if they made him into kind of more of a selfish person or more of a, you know, person not wanting to die at all. But yeah, this whole setup from the beginning to that point, you're like, well, obviously he's going to turn on them. There isn't anything in his character that's been given prior to this that would suggest he'd be willing to kill these people. And then, they don't even point their staffs at Daniel to make sure he does it. And then all the youth, somehow having not found the guns, they've learned how to successfully use the gun without any sort of training or anything at all. But yeah, they're able to get away as their robes are thrown on them and they basically run into the desert with the sandstorm coming, and Kowalski gets separated through it and Ferretti, but O'Neill and Daniel are on one, and it almost kind of feels like a scene from, again, Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back or something, where you're watching it going, are they going to have to cut the animal open to burn inside of it, or what's going to happen? But no.
Yeah, for sure. And then we get a fun scene of Ra being all villainous. Again, he doesn't, because he's got so little time to kind of make himself a presence, and make himself the kind of the big bad of the movie, even though he's just kind of stuck in the kind of final 45 minutes, they give him, they throw out this villainous scene for him, where he like basically fries one of his own henchmen for failure, with this kind of little effect, where he grabs, like the henchman's head and then just kind of zaps him. And yeah, I mean, the effects are kind of all right. Apparently, like the little eye effects, the little glowy eye effects were put in post-production because the initial test audience didn't think he was alien enough. So they were like, oh, putting the little glowy eye.
No, what I was saying was that, yeah, it's, you can really kind of feel that after the fact, with the effects, because it feels off in a way. Of the eyes changing colors. And so that makes sense what you were talking about. And I forgot to mention that Ra waited on by a bunch of children, which I'll talk about when the ending happens, because it kind of plays into something that the film doesn't acknowledge, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah. 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 I think I know where you're going with that. But we shall see. we keep giving kind of little promos of things that we might say later. it's a running theme of this episode for some reason.
Yeah. It's just like the movie in itself of being kind of a promo for the trilogy that they wanted to do, or a promo for the TV
series. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, even though apparently, yeah, the TV series thing is weird because apparently MGM wanted Dean Devlin and Roland Emmerich to audition to create the TV series. It developed in a strange way. I think Carl Cole Pictures had to sell off a bunch of things. Because basically they were about to go under and they had like one last throw of the dice, with Cutthroat Island, which obviously didn't go well. And, they were selling things off. And one of the things they sold off, was this, to MGM, who distributed the movie, but didn't produce the movie. And, and MGM almost immediately wanted to make this into a TV show. And Dean Devlin apparently felt very aggrieved for many years that they never got to do the sequels, and they were basically shut out of the TV show and basically hated the TV show for years, but then came to peace with it and apparently made friends with one of the co-creators of the TV show, Jonathan Glasner. So it all worked out happily in the end. But as we return to the movie, this is where Daniel discovers that Shaori is his wife. He didn't realize that before, but he's like, oh, okay. And there's a little scene where somebody refers to him as Shaori's husband, and he's like, what, husband? And yes, so that was a marriage ceremony that he went through. And then there's a kind of little scene where there's just, it's like, oh, and now they are together because the plot says so. Where he's like, she's like, oh, I won't tell him that you don't want me. And he's like, what? No, of course I want you. And and they're like an item now. They're just a married couple now.
Well, and that, yeah. I guess kind of plays into a lot of those other movies like that. And you end up, it feels really forced. I mean, that whole kind of thing. And I know in SG-1 there, she's in it a little bit, but yeah, it's kind of, it all just feels forced. And after the fact, all the scenes kind of, or all the scenes after this don't necessarily even fit more into it. I don't know. It's another thing that meanders away from the main plot.
Yeah. But then the main plot gets back into action as we have like they find the Daniel finds the seventh symbol. There is a fight back at the mines, and Kasuf, the chieftain, is outraged by this and is like, "No, what are you doing? You're gonna fuck everything up." But then there's a little button on the kind of helmets that the gods have, and it reveals the face of Horus, the character played by Dungeon Hunzu, And it's like, look, this is your gods. And then they're like, all right, yeah, right, fair enough. That changes everything. We thought that's what they actually looked like. We didn't think they looked like us. Well, fuck them then.
Yeah. Ra is basically going to be sending the nuke with the new components made from the Stargate, which will be, once it goes through the Stargate, back to Earth and erupts, so basically destroy the whole planet. And they also want to send a bunch of other things, so the caravan is coming of, apparently, they assume slaves to place into the, for stuff to place into the Stargate. But as we know, the audience, as we've seen it many times, the reveals is that all the soldiers and the rebels now are all kind of the ones in disguise as these slaves delivering these items and walking past the guards, all that, until their big reveal, which creates the huge action scene with one group on the inside, which is O'Neill, Daniel, and then Kowalski and Ferretti and their team are on the outside taking on like the fighter jet things and the outside forces.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things like I wanted to highlight. One from the behind the scenes, because it's hilarious. This story definitely needs to be told. So from the behind the scenes documentary, the kind of gliders, the fighter gliders that Ra's men have that are like shooting the lasers onto the rebels. So the design of those gliders, Roland Emmerich had a particular design in mind, and basically they look like kind of little flying kind of anchors, you know. It's an odd kind of clunky looking design, but the producer didn't like the look of them, and he was like, no, you can't have spaceships like this. And then one of the production designers showed a design to Roland Emmerich that was a kind of bird-like design for Ra's belt buckle, and you know, he showed him his straightways up, and then like basically, Roland Emmerich kind of turned it, you know, on its side, and it was like, oh, this would make a cool spaceship. Make me a spaceship like that. And the guy was like, all right.
I didn't know that. I mean, they look good. You know, it kind of reminds me, actually watching this movie and knowing that he would do Independence Day, a lot of Stargate, especially in the design, some of the alien elements, it feels like a precursor to Independence Day of like testing stuff out before they did that one.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I feel like, this is a test run for a bunch of that stuff. And obviously, Independence Day has a slightly higher budget. So this film had a budget of something like $55 million, whereas Independence Day, I think, was something like $75 million. So they got an extra $20 million to play with. I think you can see the difference on screen, because Independence Day actually does look like a much bigger scale movie. And like, they nailed the tone with that one as well. And talking of the tone, one of the things I put in my notes was that in that scene where they kind of sneak in and pretend to be the slaves or whatever, there's a bit where O'Neill kind of says like, ah, how are you doing? And I've put in here, O'Neill gets quippy at 1 hour and 38 minutes into the runtime.
Yeah. No, that was in my notes as well. It feels weird, because if he was like that throughout, it makes sense. But through a lot of it, he was kind of brooding and all that. And so, yeah, at this point, it almost feels too late for that. And then he goes back to brooding for a second. And I mean, you do find out with the bomb, O'Neill was never planning to come back. It was just on that whole mission where they packed all the stuff for, but it was just supposed to be a, you know, I guess a day trip in and out. O'Neill was always going to basically stay behind to set the bomb off that would just blow up the Stargate, and until he gets talked to by Daniel about, you know, fighting for life and, you know, one of those whole chats that you have in movies like this. But I think Kurt Russell is great in it, and I think he works well, but it definitely is one of those things where from the script perspective or directorial perspective, it goes back and forth a lot.
Yeah, for sure. And it is just weird that he, like, yeah, there is a little bit again where he's showing the signs of being suicidal, which he's shown a couple of times throughout the movie, but not enough for it to feel kind of solid as a through line. And then, yeah, he's just in this kind of like last 20 minutes, he's just kind of quippy, which Kurt Russell is good at. He's good at being quippy, but like, it just feels weird that it happens, so late on in the film. But yes, I suppose we should truck on with the plot goings on. And, this is a stage where like, Daniel is back in he Shuri gets injured at this stage. Daniel transports himself to the throne room to try and save Shuri with the magic water that's kind of goopy stuff that's unexplained in the watery tomb, which heals stuff. And O'Neill is having a big battle with Anubis, and he gets obviously his best quippy line of "Give my regards to King Tut, asshole," just as Anubis is decapitated by the kind of transporter thing where there's like these kind of mini stargates like come down and then they kind of teleport down in a kind of tractor beam, which looks pretty cool. I like that effect. What do you think?
Yeah, I like the effect too. I think it worked kind of well. And what happens is, when one comes down on one side, it also comes down on the other. So if you happen to be on the other side of it, the upper floor of this elevator, or however I'd put it, then you would get transported down to the bottom, which happens with Daniel as he's kind of getting his brain fried by Ra. But then he's saved because the transporter then comes down and sends him back down with Nauri. And only the head is transported back up of Anubis to the top half.
And then it's kind of weird because like after having so many kind of random filler scenes where we're just kind of hanging out, we're just meeting characters, we're just kind of hanging out, and the movie just like wraps up like real quick. So like on the outside, it looks like it's all gone wrong. You know, the spaceships are firing at the handful of rebels plus the soldiers, and it looks like, you know, Ra's men are got the upper hand and all that. And then, of course, riding to the rescue, we see Kasuf, the chieftain, on one of the sand dunes, and then loads of people just suddenly appear. It's one of those classic kind of action beats. And then Ra's men are kind of look up, and then they're just kind of like, we're clearly fucked now. and then, on the inside, we've had that, you know, like Anubis is defeated, you know, Horus is defeated, everybody's defeated, and then it wraps up really real quick. And then Ra basically decides to flee. He's like, oh, well, the rebellion's on. This reminds me of what happened back in ancient Egypt on Earth. I'm going to have to go to a new planet, get some new slaves. And then, O'Neill and Jackson both look at each other, going, I've got an idea, because like we've discovered that O'Neill now can't turn off the nuke. Whatever Ra has done to it, the nuke now cannot be turned off. And they both have the same idea at the same time. And what's that idea, Craig?
The idea is that they're going to send, since Anubis's arm is still on their side, that means he has the button to start the transporter. So they're going to send the bomb into Ra's ship, which is now, it's out in outer space. So they send the bomb there. When it arrives into Ra's ship, he sees that there's only, I think, like about 8 seconds left. And as he's kind of transporting to back into his original alien form, and the part that, of course, I was going to bring up earlier, is that all of his kind of servants that are a ton of children, you can only assume are also on board. And so, but that's never, we don't talk about that. We don't see them during this whole thing. We just know that apparently there's a bunch of children that Daniel and O'Neill just knew.
Yeah. that point kind of just reminds me of Randall's speech in Clerks about the independent contractors on the still being constructed second Death Star in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's an entirely fair point, you know, like we have apparently just killed off a bunch of kids. This is another thing that apparently didn't go down well with Death Screening audiences was not the kid. Nobody brought up the kids, apparently. This is something just you have brought up. Nobody apparently cared about the kids. But we just got a shot of the spaceship exploding, apparently, in the original ending. That was just it. It was a shot of the spaceship exploding, but no shot of Ra himself dying. Apparently audiences did not like that. And that's, they later inserted the shot of like Ra being like incinerated.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, it works. You kind of see Ra switches back to his alien form and then he's eviscerated that way. But yeah, after this point though, it just, again, what you were saying, Scott, is it just wraps up really quick. It's like, oh, okay, they're going back home. Daniel's staying and they say, I'll see you, you know, I'll see you around or whatever. And then it's done. And he hands, O'Neill the locket saying, give this back to Catherine. But yeah, it feels, that it ends really abruptly. Like you could tell that they were planning for it to be a trilogy instead of making one solid movie first and then, you know.
Yeah, I definitely think so. Like there's a lot of stuff in here and a lot of stuff that's not like fully developed. But you know, as we have pretty much now reached the end of the movie, like you said, that's basically it. It wraps up. Daniel decides to stick with love, and he is now apparently happily married to Shairi, and is going to stay on the planet. And then apparently the second one was going to take place like 12 years later. There's something, an event that happens that inspires Daniel to have to come back on Earth, which probably we'd get into more of like the origins of the Stargate, or you know, but yeah, I don't know, like it still overall works. I think the film is still overall a fun film. There is some odd character choices. There is some, the through lines are, you know, in terms of the character arcs, are a bit wonky at times. The pacing is a bit wonky at times, and the tonal shifts are a bit wonky at times. But for all that, and for all the kind of derivative parts as well, it's still a pretty fun film.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's definitely one. I'm glad I watched it. And again, we've talked about some of the other movies too, especially in the Stallone season or whatever, where if I watched it just on my own, I think, and not for the sake of, you know, going scene by scene like we do in this podcast, I'd probably have different viewing of it or whatever, but I enjoyed it. And I mean, I would definitely, I'm surprised, you know, based on that Universal Soldier kind of did a sequel reboot or whatever. And then, Independence Day did their 20 years after or whatever, however long after. But yeah, I'm surprised they haven't with Stargate tried to do one now of bringing back Spader and Kurt Russell, because I know they both said that they'd be interested in returning at some point. But overall, I mean, I enjoyed it. It's a lot of fun. I think it would be one of those where it'd be a lot of fun to watch in a theater.
Yeah, I definitely think so. You know, I imagine I never saw this in the cinema. You know, when I was a kid, I saw it on video and then I saw it a couple of times on television, but I think it'd be, yeah, a lot of fun to see on the big screen. And apparently there has been attempts to kind of do some of those sequels a couple of times, but I think they've kind of given up on it. Basically, at one of the, I think it was Comic-Con 2006, Dean Devlin mentioned that he was in discussions with MGM about doing the sequels that were not made, that originally Emmerich and himself wanted to do after they finished wrapping Independence Day. But then, of course, MGM wanted to go ahead with the TV series, not sequels to the movie. And then, so, yeah, 2006, there were some discussions, but they were never, they never fully went anywhere. But there was, like, an official announcement of, like, a reboot of Stargate to be done with Emmerich, with Devlin in, like, 2013. And apparently that the discussions did go further, and they did come pretty close to starting something. But then again, it just got into development hell. And, the last that was heard was some years back, I think 2016, Devlin did an interview with Empire, where it was like, no, this falling apart again. And he just wants to concentrate on working with he's got his own production company and doing stuff, more independently and not kind of, it seems like he can no longer be arsed, kind of dealing with studio politics, and is more interested in doing stuff, for his own production company. And it seems like Emmerich is kind of doing, his own thing. So yeah, the Stargate reboot is probably something, we're not going to see.
That's a shame, because I think, again, like we've talked about, with this one, and especially the series of, I feel like there, again, I guess repeating myself, I feel like there is a lot of potential, and there is kind of a lot of world built around this whole franchise that you could really do something pretty cool with it. But I mean, I'm fine with the way it is now too.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. Like, there's stuff in this movie where you're just like, oh, you could give a bit more explanation to that, or, oh, you could fill this character out a bit more, you know, or you could add this little touch and give me some answers to this or that. But it is what it is, and I still enjoy this movie, and I still enjoyed, like, you know, SG-1 when I watched this, when I watched that, in my teens and stuff like that, and into my 20s. I think it stopped in 2006 or something, so I'd be like 21. And then, yeah, I think Arc of Truth, the first sequel, was not long after that. So yes, when it was on, I enjoyed it. And if there was a reboot, I'd probably check it out, because I still feel, even with there being three TV shows and this movie and all this other stuff out there, I still think the original concept is a great concept. The Stargate concept is a great concept, and there's still way more that I think you could do with it. And yeah, if there is more Stargate to be had, then bring it on. I'll check it out.
Yep. And so that is kind of our ending for this one, which, yeah, again, it ends very abruptly, but that's all I have left on it.
Yep. that I think we have said everything that we have to say on Stargate, and we're kind of jumping ahead. We're not filling in the gaps. We're ending abruptly. We are very much on brand for this movie. So that's just our thoughts, though. If you really love Stargate, you know, write in, tell us. If you really don't like Stargate, write in, tell us. Or if you're kind of in the middle, you like it, but you don't necessarily love it, you know, like us, if you agree with us, if you disagree with us, it doesn't matter. We just like the feedback. So tell us your thoughts, and thank you very much for listening to this latest episode of All 90s Action All the Time. it just leaves me to thank my host, Craig, for joining me once again on this latest episode. And Craig, as always, can you give everybody your social media details and tell them where they can talk to you or shout at you or whatever our audience particularly wants to do?
Of course, yeah. My social media, you can just look me up at Craig Drahm, D-R-A-H-E-I-M, on Twitter or Instagram. I think it's craig.drahm, if I remember correctly. I'm pretty sure there's only one or two Craig Drahms, so it's pretty easy to find. Also, the podcast I co-host, Bloodhound Picks, where we will kind of highlight obscure or independent older horror films. We bring people within the horror community from bloggers to filmmakers to whatever it may be and kind of talk about what it's like working in that community. But you can find that at Bloodhound Picks, P-I-X, and that's on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, anywhere you want to look, or even the website bloodhoundpicks.com. But yeah, as always, thank you so much for having me, Scott. And it's always a pleasure to do this with you.
And if you want to talk to this podcast directly, you can do that on our Twitter page at 90s all. That's our Twitter handle. And if you want to listen to me talking about horror, you can at my podcast New Horror Express, which you can check out at my website newhorrorexpress.com, or you can check us out on Facebook or check us out on Twitter at New Horror EXP. But that is all for this episode. The last thing it leaves me to say is if you have enjoyed this episode, then it would be great if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. And please, can you make those reviews 5 stars? Because if you don't make the reviews 5 stars, it upsets the podcast algorithm gods. And as we all obey the laws of the podcast algorithm gods as podcasters and don't want to upset them, we've got to make those reviews 5 stars. So thanks again for your 5-star review. But anyway, that's all for this time. But be sure to join us next time when we will be talking about Executive Decision, which we did not talk about last week, even though we're putting out the week after this. Again, like this movie, don't think about the logic of it too much. Thanks for listening. See you next time.